Welcome back to episode 325. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Tim. I mean, this last week had the passing away of Heinz Alfred Kissinger, sometimes known as Henry, the great diplomat. How will the world get along without him?
Well, it got to 1923 without him. And I suspect it'll exist after him. 100 years old. He was quite spry. He went, I think it, this last this year he went to China, at least reportedly. So, and he was still doing cogent interviews. Much more cogent than Joe Biden. He was quite the figure. Yeah, so he was one of these towering figures of the post-war era. Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, PhD, academic expert, crackpot. Some say he was the partial inspiration for Dr. Strangelove character in Stanley Kubrick's movie, although other people said it was Herman Kahn, so it was probably a composite of both of them. Although Kissinger, of course, wasn't a paperclip Nazi as the character Dr. Strangelove, at least it suggested he was. He was a Jewish refugee from Nazi Germany, came, I think, to the U.S. 1938, enjoyed a meteoric rise. I think he, 1943, was drafted into the U.S. Armed Services because of his ability to speak German. He was, I guess, recruited into the Intelligence Bureau. He reportedly lived it up in occupied Germany. I think he occupied a castle or something. 20-year-old sergeant. But that's life of many people in the U.S. military in World War II and the post-war, kind of living it up in other countries on the taxpayers' dime. It's not just a job, it's an adventure, as one of the branch services say. But that's Henry Kissinger. He apparently, he went to Harvard, right? He's a Harvard man. Harvard, he's a Harvard man. So he got under that. I guess he wasn't affected by the quota they had on Jews back then. I mean, maybe they had lifted it by then. Went to Harvard. Apparently, his education was paid for by the Rockefellers and reportedly also the CIA. At least maybe his postgraduate work was done, and he immediately became sort of this advisor, academic to multiple presidents. I think it wasn't until the Nixon administration that he actually served. Directly in the U.S. government as a national security advisor. 1971, he was key in the Nixon administration's playing the China card, opening up China. This, of course, is during the Cold War. He spearheaded detente with the Soviets. This is the shuttle diplomacy. He was instrumental in bailing out Israel in 1973, the Yom Kippur War. He also struck the petrodollar deal that we've talked about so often. In the past, this idea that the dollar in 1971 was cut off from gold after Nixon closed the gold window. There was a collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the post-war monetary system that was devised in 1944 that was supposed to last forever. It lasted 27 years because of US government profligacy. It couldn't. So they had to sever the tie from gold and they created the fiat dollar. Then it was attached to the value of oil, at least the sale of oil. This is a deal that he struck with the Saudis. At the same time, he's negotiating with the Israelis, of course. Some people have also said that he helped foment the Yom Kippur War to create the energy crisis. We can talk about some of his diplomacy, if you will, his strategy. He was an expert, supposedly, in balance of power diplomacy, something that we don't really see anymore in the declining or decaying unipolar world. There was a sense that you had spheres of influence. He wrote books about this, particularly he cited examples of 19th century Europe, which struck a balance of power, avoided a general war after Napoleon had been defeated. And that was his thing, supposedly. He engaged in a lot of like dirty tricks, as you'd expect someone organizing a global empire. We can talk about some of that too, in Chile, of course, and in East Timor, Indonesia, approving the shipment of weapons. He wasn't alone in this guilt. This is a part of the Cold War and managing the American Empire and how it fought the Cold War, a lot of dirty wars, Vietnam. We can talk the bombing of Cambodia. We can talk about his guilt in that. Cambodia, of course, was neutral, but nevertheless, the US government, although Nixon is blamed for starting that. For understand, we was in a sense learned that U.S. had been bombing Cambodia as early as 1965 because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the supply routes that the North Vietnamese were using cut through Cambodia. And so that became a pretext for the U.S. bombing Cambodia. But it was out in the open with Nixon in the early 70s. This created a lot of outrage. This reignited the anti-war movement. At the same time, under Nixon, he extricated the United States from the Vietnam quagmire that successive administrations had gotten the country into, dating as far back as the Truman administration. But there's a lot going on there, too, we can talk about. It wasn't just a war to prevent the domino theory from happening. It was a lot more going on there. Opium trade, CIA, these things. Then after, I think it was after Ford was defeated, because he was also the National Security Advisor and Secretary of State for Ford. After Ford left office in 1977, after Jimmy Carter defeated him, he went private, and he opened up Kissinger Associates in 1980 or 81, at the young age of 58 or 59, relatively lived 100, so he had a lot left in him. And of course, he became a multimillionaire, and some people say this was an example of he's one of the first examples of one of these public servants cashing in, becoming a multimillionaire, and he became sort of an advisor to successive presidents. He was rather spry. I think, as reported last year, I think he went to China last year at age 99 or 100, and he was still giving interviews. That distinctive voice, although ever aged. He dated Jill St. John, the Bond girl. He actually dated, and I think he's the one that said that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac. That's why he was able to get chicks. Henry not being a particularly attractive man, but he lived that fast track lifestyle, hanging out at Studio 54 with the it girls of the day and the celebrities and all the important people of the day. But he's moved on to his eternal reward, whatever that is. Maybe he was uploaded to the mothership and he's been reunited with David Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller. That's apparently who he primarily worked for. But Henry Kissinger, what say you?
Well, Henry was a lifetime actor, what I call a lifetime actor. He was a personality that the oligarchs created and presented to the public, you know, through the media. One of the things that is not often mentioned about him is that he's the son of a rabbi. So that's that is his background. A rabbinical background. Family is a banking family.
So he had a strong religious upbringing.
Evidently, very Talmudic, and low banking family is sort of where he descends from.
I'm sorry. Did you say Loeb?
Yeah, Loeb.
As in Kuhn Loeb.
It is exactly that family, though it's spelled differently. But it comes from the same area of Germany. So I'm just going to assert that there's a strong relationship there. His great-great-grandfather, someone, Meyer Loeb, and he's the one who actually changed the name to Kissinger. It was back, you know, in 18, whatever. Kissinger, you can see, you know, like I've mentioned before, my idea that the most important thing to understand sort of what is happening to us is to look for what is inexplicable. Things which are completely inexplicable are typically... these are ways in which we can, upon analysis, see, you know, that there's artificiality to, you know, kind of the explanation of reality that we're being given. With Kissinger, the inexplicableness starts really with his career in the military in World War II. He became a very important person in the counterintelligence corps. Mm-hmm. And the explanation for that is that he could speak German. But you have to remember that German was the second most common language in America at this time. And there were hundreds of thousands of people who could speak German. So really wasn't that unusual. But somehow he was selected and then was given incredible power. At the age of 20, he actually was given sort of absolute authority and the power of arrest over an entire district of Germany.
Age 20, that's rather heady stuff.
Yeah, very amazing, you know. And so now from
So
here,
he became like an American Gauleiter.
exactly right. And then from there, he, even though he, was a good student, of course, there are many of these, he somehow is admitted into Harvard, where he develops the philosophy that is then given to the public and is really the rationale for his lifetime actor role. He talks about legitimacy. What does this mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything at all. It's just sophistry. He wrote a couple of long theses, one of which was The Meaning of History. There's a kind of a modest title. And it was like 500 pages long. And the only thing about it that's really useful is that it was so long and impossible to get through that they actually created a regulation limiting the length of master theses after Kissinger's tome had been just so, waste such a waste of paper. Now, you can go into this stuff if you can't sleep at night. It kind of reminds me, if you've ever gone through any of his writings, it kind of reminds me of the two things that come to mind are Helen Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine and the Playboy Philosophy that Hefner purportedly wrote. I mean, it's just endless, kind of quasi-rational points, which are all leading up to the idea that you really don't have to worry about slaughtering humans. Legitimacy is basically if the great powers agree to the genocide, then it sort of you don't really need to wonder whether or not there's some sort of moral violation here. His study is kind of interesting. It's also kind of worthy of some at least notice. He studied like the middle 19th century, kind of political machinations. Now, the reason he did this, what he's really doing, it's quite interesting. This was when you had Palmerston Zoo. I mean, bear in mind, this is exactly when Palmerston said, "Now is the time for the Jews to return to the homeland," which was the indication that the Freemasons had now control over enough of the political power of Europe that they could think about these great structural maneuvers, right? There wasn't going to be anyone that could stand in opposition to them. They had taken over the political power of Europe. And so what Kissinger is actually studying when he talks about, like the kind of his concept of legitimate, comes from his analysis of how Poland was partitioned. And he basically just said there that after like 10,000 pages that, well, we don't really have to worry about either public opinion or morality. I mean, these are just kind of necessary things that get crushed and are irrelevant because all that really matters is the great powers in agreement. Now, this is really you can see that the sophistry is very predictable, and in a genre, it's the same one that Ayn Rand comes up with. I mean, it's a little different. She talks about the individual. Henry's talking about, countries, but it's the same ultimate thing that empathy and concern for other people and for murdering and things like this are pretty much irrelevant. I mean, they don't say this out loud, but this is what the point is. It's really the greatness that is important. So the greatness of countries, the greatness of individuals, it all leads to this rationale where you shouldn't be questioning if there's any sort of moral concern for the oligarchs destroying people in order to rule the world, right? So this is really what Kissinger was. He was in the genre of Adam Smith, the Wealth of Nations, which was put out by the East Asian trading companies to justify, slavery. And there, Smith came up with the idea that you really shouldn't impede the hidden hand of free markets because otherwise you could stop this good thing from happening. And the example he gave as to, you know, what's a good example of this was opium. Opium was something you didn't really want to regulate because, gee whiz, the free market needs to expand and it'll ultimately end in a good place because there'll be more commerce. And of course, there'll be more power focused in the trading companies, which of course are just an annex of Freemasonry. And so, you know, after all of this, along comes Kissinger, and, you know, he comes up with his concept of legitimacy, which is just a rationale for, you know, oligarch and hegemon slaughter of particularly, you know, like peasant populations. I'll just finish my little rant here by pointing out that Kissinger is known as a diplomat. I don't know how anyone can use that term, which typically indicates, you know, that there is some kind of, you know, exchange of ideas and a process that goes on, hopefully with the idea of like not creating genocide and carnage. But even though Kissinger claims to come from this background or this perspective, every single time Henry gets involved with anything, you see hundreds of thousands of people dying. I mean, I could give you a list of like 15 international situations that Kissinger was involved with. Every time, no matter how even trivial how they start out, when Henry shows up at the end of it, the bodies are just from here to the horizon. So this is Kissinger. He's a lifetime actor he's a creation, an artificial creation, obviously, of the Judeo-Masonic hegemon. And his purpose was to create a kind of smokescreen for genocide with his Harvard education and, the rationale for legitimacy and the great powers are more important than the morality that would protect individual humans. So he's just about as evil as anything that is imaginable. He's dead. It's a shame he didn't die 100 years earlier.
Yeah, he was, you know, Machiavellian is the term you describe him. I often use that, hear that description of his ideas. And no, he wasn't a sentimentalist, you could say. He's a product sort of the post-war, I think of the television age, because the image he presented of this awkward, you know, the glasses, the thick glasses, the accent, which he never seemed to shed. I think he worked on it to present an image. And he openly talked about the New World Order, this planning and these things. The interests, the concerns, the values of the little people, the hoi polloi, who do most of the living and dying in the world and actually paying for everything that works, because it's their labor that produces it. It was always about, you know, manipulating, moving pieces on a chessboard, changing colors on a map, and never thinking about the humanitarian cost, the human cost on the ground for these things. He had the Cold War to justify this. Vietnam justified a heck of a lot. And, staging a coup because the government would be more friendly to the US and to the United States and the West as opposed to the Soviet Union. This isn't to say that some of the governments he overthrew were nice governments, that, you know, they were good governments, but nevertheless, the US was involved and shouldn't have been. This is something that the U.S. did, particularly after the Second World War. It was institutionalized with the Central Intelligence Agency, although the agency was supposedly created to collect and collate intelligence and give it to the president. It immediately developed a special operations branch that would conduct assassinations, subversion, not just abroad but also domestically, as we've come to learn. Because the 1970s, when Kissinger was at his peak of his power, you did have some revelations with the congressional hearings, the Pike Committee hearings. What was the other one again? Senator Frank Church had these hearings. And of course, what was exposed was CIA had, well, like, remember, you can watch a video of them looking at their heart attack gun.
Yeah.
We talked about assassination. MK Ultra. That was domestic. But also you had the Operation Mockingbird was revealed, And that never went away, of course. The manipulation of the US media, news, entertainment, academia, basically controlling the flow of information. I believe he served as early as the Eisenhower administration on the Psychological Warfare Strategy Board, which was C.D. Jackson's operation.
Yeah, that's right.
And what they mean by that, the Psychological Strategy Board, is they're not targeting the Russians, they're manipulating the American people, to and so that's one thing you people to understand. That's the target of their psychological manipulation. You have to scare the hell out of the American people, as Senator Vandenberg told Harry Truman. Harry Truman started the announced the Truman Doctrine. In order to get America on board this thing, you have to scare the hell out of them. So he was all part of that, all part of that sort of milieu, if you will, that culture. And he rose up quickly through the ranks because, as you said, he was sponsored. He was a recipient of Rockefeller largesse and also CIA largesse. Apparently, he also he groomed Klaus Schwab.
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Henry, remember, just bear in mind, Henry had two points of attack against humanity. One was, creating dead bodies, but the other was chemical assaults into the body. He was very pharmaceutical, and certainly, you could see this with his promotion of Schwab and Schwab's role in the vaccines and the pandemic and the World Health Organization. Henry was very big on the idea that in the future, you could create control over populations through vaccines and this sort of stuff. There are quotes ascribed to him which are really genocidal, but they're hard to get a really perfect citations on. It's like these quotes kind of circulate on the internet, and I don't know if there's a real citation in back or not. But certainly his behavior and his role in international politics was just part of that. It was all, the World Health Organization, Schwab's participation in it. These are all descendants, from Kissinger's activity,
Yeah, of course, this was, I think, put on paper and sort of instantiated in many ways in his infamous National Security Study Memorandum 200. It was a 200-page study that written or released in 1974. I heard read somewhere that he might have written some of it while under the influence of LSD, which wouldn't shock me. The study claimed that the it was basically, the title was National Security Study Memorandum 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. So there's that cold, hard interest there. You see, with Kissinger, like to talk about interest. The study falsely claimed that the population growth in the so-called lesser developed world, this is the third world, lesser developed countries, rather, was a threat to U.S. national security. Official policy was adopted in November of 1975. This is under the Gerald Ford administration. Of course, Gerald Ford had become president because Nixon had resigned, and Spiro Agnew had also resigned before Nixon. So Gerald Ford was a completely unelected president. He was installed. Ford also served on the the Warren Commission. Interesting connection there. And also, it was through the Ford administration that we got the personages of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. So, thank you very much. National Security Study Memorandum outlined a covert plan to reduce population growth in targeted countries through the use of birth control, also through promotion of war and famine. So, there's that genocide. Coercion would be a big part of this as well, although Henry Kissinger wrote that. That you might not want to publicly admit that. So use it covertly. Foreign aid, relief, and also, and this is something that where I, it was key, because you have this, that you have NSSM 200 being released in 1974. You also have the Yom Kippur War and the ensuing energy crisis and the 400% spike in the cost of oil, which played a key part in impoverishing the third world and curbing development. So the question was, the Yom Kippur War fomented to create the material conditions to bring about the population reduction and also the ensuing debt crisis that the Third World experienced.
And also remember, because this is very timely, Kissinger really is one who oversaw the, kind of diplomatic conclusion of the 73 Yom Kippur Arab-Israeli War. And this was what created the West Bank and Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
This was really how they got set up and ossified. This was supposed to, as it was presented to the Palestinians, this was to protect them. We can see how that worked out. But actually, particularly when you could see how the control that Israel had over both of these regions, you could see this was just setting them up for a long-term genocidal process. And again, it's Henry's bumbling diplomacy. No matter how hard he tries, he always ends up with millions of bodies all around him. And he always has the rationale that he's just trying so hard to prevent all of this, but somehow never can quite get that done. But the bodies just keep piling up, over and over again. The one of the quotes that I'm just going to mention now, I have a good citation on this, but I want listeners to remember that this at least can be contested. It was his speech at the HWO, who, they actually had a council on eugenics. That's true. And and Henry spoke. And the quote that has come from this, which is considered legitimate, is he said that once they, the population accepts mandatory vaccination, it's game over. They'll accept anything, forcible blood or organ donation for the greater good. We can genetically modify children and sterilize them for the greater good. Control sheep mines and you control the herd. Vaccine makers will make billions, and many of you in this room are investors. It's win-win. We thin out the herd and the herd pays us for extermination services. Okay, so that's the quote.
That's the quote?
That is a quote. I don't know if it's true. I know that there are reasonable people who do believe it, and there has been research into it. I know that he did speak at the session and that this is what is claimed to have come from it. But, Tim, I would just say it's almost irrelevant. Well, not irrelevant, but it's the greater fact is that this is exactly the policy that comes out of Kissinger's political activity.
Well, I mean, there are confirmed quotes that are just as bellicose and anti-human. So,
yeah. Well, look at the quote from Schwab. Kissinger created Klaus Schwab, mm-hmm. right? I mean, in the same way that the Rockefellers and the oligarch can be said to have created Kissinger, where does Schwab come from heaven's sakes? He was just a protege of Kissinger who suddenly comes into the media world as a enormous force with hundreds of millions of dollars at his disposal. And you get these weird quotes from him, which are justifications of, basically genocide. And so he's just Kissinger and the next generation. So I think the quote, if I hear of a contradiction to it, if I find that the citation is false, I'll definitely mention it in the another podcast. But at the moment, I'm going to just present it because I think it comes from credible sources. And in any case, it's a good description of what he has done, if not exactly what he said.
Yeah, regarding the National Security Study Memorandum 200, he called for mandatory. Actually, this is from the paper. Mandatory programs may be needed and should be considering, and we should be considering these possibilities now. The document continued, added, "World food be considered an instrument of national power." Yeah. Would world food be considered international power? So, food is a weapon. Is the U.S. prepared to accept food rationing to help people who can't, who won't control their population growth? So he has a sort of this. Well, it's fitting because he talks about Adam Smith, and is fully bought into the Malthusian vision of humanity. I mean, the problem is too many people. You have to reduce the people. So he comes up with this with his own version of a modest proposal, if you will.
And again, that's just, it's all sophistry. Yeah. This is all simply a rationale being given to the public so they are less critical of being genocided.
Well, if you're fomenting civil,
they're eating too much, they're polluting too much. The great powers need to have maneuvering room in order to create the, you know, workers' paradise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's all just a lump of absolute nonsense. It's just being given to us to impede our ability to think clearly about the fact that the Judeo-Masonic hegemon is killing us.
Yeah, I mean, good example, take a country like Guatemala in the 1950s. A lot of Guatemalans had made their way up to the United States for, you know, to provide cheap labor, hell at labor, for the upper middle class and corporations. But if in the 1950s the CIA had not engaged in a coup and overthrow the regime there, the Arbenz regime, which was carrying out land reform, they were taking fallow land, idle land that was owned by the United Fruit Company, a company that was paying no tax on that land, property taxes, or very little, the discount tax. And they were doing more or less a, you know, they were purchasing land at the rate that the United Fruit Company said was worth based on their taxes.
Right.
And so basically people have been, over generations, have been forced off the land or denied land, arable land, where they can provide for themselves and also provide a domestic market for food, for agricultural production. You know, feed themselves, I'm just saying, feed themselves. Yep. And the population would grow accordingly without any meddling. But that wasn't to be, because the CIA intervened and overthrew the government and installed a dictator on behalf of the United Fruit Company. And the country experienced 30, 40 years of civil war and violence, and you had people had to leave, and you had migration to other countries, particularly north. But that wasn't to be. So someone like Kissinger, well, he'll look at a current situation in a country, at the political instability, lack of development, and go, oh, you know, this situation is impossible. There's too many people here. But he won't address at least a partial responsibility that multinational corporations have in destabilizing that country. There are development models that actually allow people to become self-sufficient, and they don't have to emigrate. They don't become a population threat. But he looks at humanity as a threat. The portion of humanity that he can't control is the threat. At least yeah. That the people he's serving, the oligarchs, and that's the problem. That's this Malthusian crackpot. This is why everything ends up in wars and bombing people and killing people and impoverishing people. And at the same time, a whole lot of wealth isn't produced or redistributed, and the world's a lot poorer for it. But a very few get rich in the process. Then they call it capitalism. You know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the Adam Smith model. It's the British model.
Exactly right. I mean, yeah. I actually had the first time I really, because, you know, Kissinger was very big in the Vietnam War, which I was trying to avoid being drafted into, and had the strategy of going to college, which seemed ridiculous to me at the time, but at least it kept me out of the war. So, okay. But in any case, after that, I went down to South America and was trying to, trying to be sober and also to do reporting. I failed at both. And, but in the middle of all that, I got a little bit of a taste of what was going on in Argentina. I won't go into all this kind of personal stories, but there was some horrible things going on, and stories were circulating. And after the fact, when I came back to the States, I saw the article that was in The Nation. This was in the era when there was actual journalism in the United States. Mm-hmm. And The Nation, they broke a story on a meeting, you know, between Kissinger and the Argentinian illegitimate authorities, because they had, you know, had a military coup and gotten rid of Perón and put in their dictator, the Masonic dictator. But the Nation actually got documentation of how, once again, Henry Kissinger, our diplomat, he was the one who told the Argentinian Masonic leadership that it would be okay to basically evaporate the guerrillas. These are the people who are in opposition to the dictatorship and other dissidents. And by disappearance, this was the disappearing of families. This was where I got involved with it, because I was aware of this and had some interaction with all of this. And so when I read later on that Kissinger had actually been one of the orchestrators of the policy, this made me wonder about this individual. And so, you know, I was kind of, you know, like all of us, I paid attention to him for the next like 80 years or whatever it is, you know, And he was just this. So what happened in Argentina and the rationale that Kissinger gave to the public concerning, the repression of the guerrillas and how difficult it is for the Argentinians and that communism is involved with it. And yeah. there has to be, some suppression. And I know it's going to get a little bit mussy, but great powers have this kind of transcendence of moral order in order to create ultimately, the workers' paradise. We've just got to put up with it. And in the meantime, they had tens of thousands of people in hundreds of concentration camps, families, children, and they were executing everyone because it was one of these things where, as it was explained to me later on, was they would execute a family and then they would have to go out and get the cousins and then they would just continue to expand out because they could see that this was how the chain of information was getting out to the public. So they had to not just take the political person, but his wife. The children, the cousins. Yeah. And so this was how you ended up with hundreds and hundreds of these secret concentration camps, thousands of people being executed. And Kissinger putting a smiling face on all of this, it's just, some people are getting their hair mussed because the legitimacy of the great power gives it the ability to go through and kill everybody. So, his pattern is really, I think, transparent. I think the only real value of this heinous demonic individual is that he is so obvious, right? He's so clear cut that you can use him as an example in conversation as, as to how the oligarchs use a kind of intellectual bamboozlement to justify genocide. And we have to get past the point where it's kind of the sophistry of someone like Klaus Schwab or Kissinger is anything other to us than a call to arms. We know immediately that this is just a smokescreen. This is just going to end up with lots of us dead.
Yeah, a lot of it is based on a sort of a narrative or a perception of reality they create, that the world being an inherently dangerous place, and we need people, crackpot realists like Henry Kissinger, to make the hard decisions, willing to spill blood to avoid a greater evil. That's always the rationalization for these things, right? A greater evil. We saw that in Vietnam. We see that in Indonesia, all throughout Latin America, and just constant meddling. There's never an end to it, and there's never any resolution. You'd think after so many decades of bloodshed and doing, preventing the greater evil, that they could get to some sort of equitable, just resolution to these conflicts. But as we know, there's endless conflict. There's always something else. If it isn't communism, it's Islamic terrorism, it's internet. Now it's international anti-Semitism. That is apparently the boogeyman that we ought to be concerned about. Everyone's excited about anti-Semitism, at least.
And the Ukraine and yes. Gaza. I mean, these are the examples of the last couple of months.
Again, and these conflicts are the narrative they spin are transparently false. And, Ukraine is obvious. Obviously, that was provoked and fomented. And then they spin this narrative as Putin being the next Hitler or something. And, it's just lies, towered on, plopped upon lies. And that, in the end of the day, then, you have one lie, put on dollop top of another to justify the previous lie. And this is the problem of trying to understand the modern world. It's just, it's just one Masonic hall of mirrors, and you don't know what's really going on, and it justifies continual slaughter.
Exactly. A good article you gave it to me. It was put up by Brown, I believe, and it's just.
That's a good segue. Second up, because it's about. Let me see where it is. Yeah, the post 9/11 wars have contributed to an estimated. This is the post 9/11 American wars against terrorism, estimated has contributed to 4.5 million deaths. Globally.
Yeah, now those are just, that's a cursory, because in back of that, there's also the misery index and, deaths which are not associated. It's 20 million, 30 million, who knows? It's just a huge number. They're all part of this foreign policy, which claims to be diplomacy to create the expression that Kissinger used all the time, New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, oddly enough, very, very much like the old world order, in that the Gentiles just keep getting slaughtered. So,
You meet the New World Order, same as the Old World Order, or is this?
yeah, I kind of have that impression. And so, it's just that every generation needs a new lump of sophistry and propaganda and mind control in order to not look back at history as something that should alert them to the fact that the political class is a secret society that's intent on, having a very few people on the planet and everyone else gone. So this is, our generation's moment is, you have the sophistry of, the inexplicable aspects of the Gaza genocide, right? I mean, we've talked about that. The
Well, at this
inexplicable
point,
aspects.
it's easy. They're just clearing the place out. They're destroying all the infrastructure. So there's nothing left to go back to. And they'll
Oh
say,
yeah,
"Look,
and they've
well, they
also just,
left. They left."
the war is going to take years and years.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, no one is sitting there going, well, why would the Hamas leadership not have anticipated this? Gee, it sure seems like they were committing suicide, doesn't it? Creating this pretext for genocide. But there it is. The pretext for genocide is the basic currency of the world. It is not the petrodollar. The world functions on the pretext for genocide. That is the real currency, the real political motivating, force, that the animating force for what's going on in the planet right now. And the response to this is, of course, the exposure of of the fact that we're being lied to. We're being lied to for a very specific purpose, and we're being lied to by a very narrow focused group
Would it
that
should it, I mean, should it bother people that those supposedly running the world, devising policy, implementing policy, see humanity as a problem?
Tim, you're so rational. Sometimes you make me, pull
I
my
mean,
hair out. Yeah,
I mean, wait
no,
a
that
second.
what a great point. Shouldn't that be something we're concerned about? Because it seems like whenever they talk about humanity, they always talk about it as being a huge problem, a polluter, a overeater. We,
By the way, Henry Kissinger wasn't an overeater. Yeah, right.
yeah.
It's always the other people and
Yeah. Matt Haig
that have to
sitting
be.
there in his villa in Germany, where he has
Yeah.
complete control over a whole region, stuffing himself with bratwurst and ordering the peasants into prison. And then, of course, like 15 years later, he's being held up as this important individual for future world peace. We have to. I don't know. You wonder what exactly can be given to the public as a way of looking at all of these individuals. Because remember, it is, of course, it's not just Kissinger, but it's the next generation. It's Schwab, it's Bill Gates, it's Elon Musk. All of these people, these lifetime actors that are being set up, and of course, Kissinger was famous in his role as being intelligent, right?
Yes.
He was supposed to be this really smart guy, even though his diplomacy is like basically would have a scale of efficiency, I would say, of close to
Well,
zero.
the world's a mess, but it's run by them, but we're supposed to rely on their expertise.
Right? That's exactly the rationale. And the rationale is the same thing for the vaccine. If you're sick and a lot of you are dying, but if you hadn't taken it, it'd just be so much worse.
Yeah.
So this is how, this is where the situation we find ourselves in, because like to have a lifetime actor like Kissinger, to put him in position and have him have weight and execute all of these activities that lead to genocide, you have to have media control too. That's really what it represents.
Well, where were these experts? Like, say someone like Kissinger, Brzezinski, all these experts of foreign policy, in the Second World War. Okay, now we have a Cold War. We got to fight the communists, so we got to do all these dirty things and engage in these, police actions, wars in Asia and Africa, and all these theaters of activity that create a brisk, lucrative business for arms and drug dealing and human trafficking. And a lot of fun stuff, a lot of people to get involved in. Play the spy versus spy game, all that. John Le Carré novels and that whole genre, that whole James Bond, Get Smart. I mean, this infuses the culture. Obviously the culture is infused with all this, so it's all seems normal. It all seems normal. This is just part of a complicated modern world. It comes with air conditioning and television. Nothing you can do about it. But my point is, they're looking at a map of Europe, say 1944. Very unconditional surrender. So we're going to destroy Germany and Central Europe. We're giving a huge amount of aid to Stalin's Russia, and they're going to come in Central Europe and they're going to take half of Europe.
Yeah, we're going to give them half of Europe, basically.
Wait, you couldn't see that? So you couldn't look at a map and go, "Oh, wait a second, extinguishing German power has consequences, geopolitical consequences." Like, maybe this isn't a good idea. Oh, now we have a Cold War, and then we have, and Dean Acheson, gives a speech in 1950. Or sorry, he gives a speech in early 19, yeah, January 1950. He declares Korea to be outside the security perimeter of the United States. So that June, North Korea invades South Korea, allegedly. And they have the Korean War. All of a sudden, it becomes an emergency that the UN has to get involved. They have to stop communist aggression on the Korean Peninsula. Even though Korea Peninsula was divided because of the settlement after World War II, gave half of it to Soviet supported North Korea and American supported South Korea. Then we declare it outside our defense perimeter. Then we have a war for 3 years, which devastates North Korea, kills millions of North Koreans, destroy, they still haven't recovered from it. But we're told it's just necessary because this is the modern world. This is what you do. And same thing with Vietnam, where they kick Ho Chi Minh out after the French are, obviously it was a French colony. Japanese kicked the French out 1940, 41, and it's occupied by the Japanese. Japanese are defeated. We let the French go back in with our aid. Then we abandon the French. We don't help them out. The French leave, and we have this settlement, and they're supposed to have an election. They never do. And Ho Chi Minh, although he was pro-American during the war, he became anti-American after the war because of the switch the Americans did. And then you had the contours of the Vietnam War, which involved a lot of things with CIA, OSS, intrigues and drug trade and all that. Then it's pinned on the Pentagon. That's what the Pentagon Papers were for. And it's interesting because the Pentagon Papers is Henry Kissinger, going back to Henry Kissinger, of course, is the release of the Pentagon Papers, which is kind of a limited hangout. It was a move of the CIA to blame the Pentagon for the war because Ellsberg was CIA, OSS and CIA. This
Yeah, it's
this
just like
the,
Iran-Contra. I mean,
Yeah, but
they
my
have a rash.
point is this is Kissinger declares Ellsberg the most dangerous man in the world in the country,
Right.
and then this becomes the pretext for the plumbers, right? The plumbers
Yeah.
to
Yeah.
stop leaks, to engage all types of skullduggery, black box jo black black bag jobs, black bag jobs.
Yeah.
When you break in, this G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, and of course E. Howard Hunt, Kennedy assassination. It's like. And then they get caught. And then, of course, Watergate becomes a pretext for expelling Nixon from the White House because that's the worst thing that ever happened. Worst political scandal in history was the Watergate break in the Nixon administration and cover it up. But all that's connected, And
Wow.
so, but it's Kissinger's because of Kissinger's urging Nixon to do that. It's Nixon's undoing, at least by according to the official narrative. And because the
Yeah.
Nick, you know, so, you know.
These things are, it's lifetime acting. The Watergate break-in is Monica Lewinsky without the sex. I mean, it's just, these are things to create kind of a theatrical distraction around the presidency and to debase the idea of democracy, that look, the leaders are so venal and corrupt, there's really no point in voting for anybody. It's all just going to be a big lump of chaos, so what can you do? It's so Kissinger plays a role in all of that. And when you talk about, you mentioned the kind of the inexplicable aspect, right? Again, the inexplicable is the roadmap to reality, unfortunately, in our world. You mentioned that, well, how come they gave like half of Europe to the Soviets? Didn't they see this as having some kind of potential problem, you know, downstream. And then lo and behold, it wasn't even a year later, Tim, it was just a few months. Suddenly the Soviet Union is the world's greatest enemy. They've got the atomic bomb and the Cold War breaks out. I mean, gee, this is an incredible blunder on the part of Churchill and Roosevelt. So, well, who are Churchill and Roosevelt? What are these individuals? All I can say is you want to know what they're like, who they are. There's a great exchange concerning the poem, The Burden of Jerusalem. You know, you and I have talked about it on the show many times. This is on the internet. Anyone can just go and Google The Burden of Jerusalem. You can see the nature of the poem, of its racism opposed to Gentiles, its promotion of Zionism. You can see the secrecy that Churchill and Roosevelt had to maintain concerning the poem. You can read the little cryptic remarks they make back and forth about what a wonderful thing this all is. Mm-hmm. And then with that understanding of these two individuals, now you can look at, well, what happens to Europe following World War II? It's a lot clearer, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, it's look at a map. You can tell what's going to happen. And they weren't able to, you know, all their expertise and their knowledge. Oh, look what we have. We have a Cold War now. Who could have thunk it?
Duck and cover. Yeah.
And then duck and cover. Exactly.
And the terror duck just and cover. Goes on and on and on. And yeah. And we're still terrified to this. I mean, you know, now we have zombie movies and, you know, the Kardashians, but the horror just never stopped.
Well, now you have terrorism and viruses. You know, so.
Yeah.
You know, remember buying duct tape?
Well, sure. I mean, Tim, I mean, I mean,
there was someone who killed himself because he duct taped his house. He suffocated himself because he.
Yeah, it's like people wearing masks inside of cars. The population, you know, just as individual components of the intellectual capacity to recognize reality in the world, it's been debased.
Yeah.
We are nowhere near as clear-minded as we were in, like, you know, 1905. It's all of the chemicals and all the propaganda have really had a powerful
effect. Well, you didn't have mass media in 1905.
Yeah, exactly.
There is an argument that even literacy has a negative effect. Because
it can, of course.
In order to be propagandized, you have to have a certain amount of reading level. And you have just the amount of reading level to be brainwashed. And that's kind of what the education system has produced, right?
It has, of course, because, you know, it doesn't have individuals ask the questions concerning what is being done to them and their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't in our public school system say, well, you know, I come from a European background and I see all of this promotion of different ethnicities. I don't see my ethnicity being given any in particular importance, and particularly nothing in terms of preserving it in any way, right? It's just the opposite. If you try to do that, well, here comes the authoritarian personality, political correctness, you're a racist, you know? And so this is, you know, as you say, the training that goes on, which, you know, part of which is reading, it is in the conjunction of all of this overwhelming power of critical theory and the authoritarian personality, pseudoscience. And the poor kids that come out of the school system, the best ones, the ones who had the strongest minds, they're the ones that are the most self-loathing, because that was what the whole, you know, process was for the European students.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a good example. One of the we talk about the this Brown study on the consequences of war, and obviously, if you're engaged in these types of wars, you can have, you know, civilians dying from direct action bombing. You know, collateral damage, if you will, like in Vietnam, where, you know, they had to get the body count up. So in order to get the body count up to provide some sort of measurement for progress, they had to engage in live fire, declare areas to be live fire operations, like the Mekong Delta, you know, or these villages.
And live course, fire, yeah.
Yeah, well, what that means is you're going to have a whole lot of innocent civilians dying in the process, not just, you know, combatants. And then they have the disruption of war when you have of agriculture, of water supply, infrastructure, cities being blown apart. So you get a whole lot of, you know, people dying from disease subsequently from their wounds, also just from disease and starvation. In fact, most civilians die from that. from that, rather than being shot during war, from the consequences of war, the disruption that it creates, and all this is foreseeable. Even I think in the Nuremberg trials, blamed the leadership of National Socialist Germany was not just waging aggressive war, but also they were guilty for the consequences of that war. They were complicit. I mean, not compl- they were responsible for it because the negative consequences of war are foreseeable. So you can't say I didn't know that if we waged war, that we would disrupt modern life and destroy infrastructure, which would lead to millions of women and children starving to death. You know that's going to happen. That's a consequence of war, and that should factor in whether or not you want to wage war or not. And if you do that, wage aggressive war and avoid a war, and you do that, you're guilty for those lives being lost. The same thing, of course, that direct charge, however valid point at the German leadership at that time, it can certainly be pointed at American leadership, whether it's George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, Harry Truman, or Dwight Eisenhower. They're all, if you look at their records, they're all guilty of these crimes. And this is a consequence of waging war. And that's what the study points at, that this is a consequence of war. So when Americans watch war on CNN or Fox News, and they see like a video game or entertainment. No, there's a real human, there's a real death toll to these wars abroad that the American government has seen fit to wage. I think the last time America declared war is 1942, but nevertheless, it's been at war all of like 6 or 7 years since then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, you're so right. And the thing is, the example that comes to my mind of this is the Arab support of the Allies in World War I. Mm-hmm. They agreed to fight against the Ottomans. And this was in the Hussein McMahon, exchange where this agreement was worked out, which, of course, the British Freemasons were just lying through their teeth the whole time. They were drafting the Balfour Declaration at the same time. But in any case, the point I was going to make is that so you have the blood cost, the actual deaths that the Arabs experienced as a result of signing up, with the British to fight against the Ottomans. And that's, been documented around 100,000. Mm-hmm. But the downstream cost to the Arabs, and I'm not talking about Zionism here, well, ultimately, but I'm just talking about the next 10 years of disruption and then starvation and through dislocation, declining mm-hmm. the population. They lost 5 million people, 5 million people, 50 times the amount of people who died during the war. But this was the blood price that they paid for the agreement with the British. For supposedly to have an Arab, controlled region. When you look at the document that you sent me that Brown University came out, you have the deaths, you have the bodies, but as you point out so well, look, it's the downstream costs, which are really the worst, right? When you create these wars, you always have, a pile of bodies. But you also have total disruption of, production of food, family production. I mean, there is just such an enormous cost that you would think that if there was real diplomacy in our world, we could avoid these things because it isn't just the bodies, it's also the downstream. But here's my point. That's really what they're trying to achieve. It isn't, Kissinger is not just wants the piles of bodies around him. It's the chaos and population reduction that is downstream. That's really the, what Henry was all about. That's what his life's work was. And it's I'm just hoping that there will be some people come forward and write honest books about the real consequences of his diplomacy based on his sophistry concerning legitimacy of the great powers. Because. I mean, he wiped out about, 20% of the world's population with with his ideas.
Yeah, the one that Brown study focuses on, the consequences of war, the human cost, the downstream cost of war, as you say. But one thing it doesn't cover is a lot of these wars have created a refugee crisis and a mass movement of people into Europe and into the United States. And there's a cost there too, because you've had explosion and chaos and social tension and crime throughout Europe. There's a rape crisis in Sweden, stabbings in Germany and France, and also most recently in Ireland. And one thing is telling it, no one's doing anything about it. So it's a, in fact, the government encourages it. And a good example was the reaction we talked about last week, the reaction of the Irish government to the incident, where they are more upset about the reaction to it as opposed to the actual crime itself, and how this crime is again one of many that's being committed in Ireland due to,
Inexplicable. It's so inexplicable. And Tim, that the crazed Algerian who stabbed all of the Irish kids. Okay, I read. We talked about. We questioned this, and I read he'd been in the country for 20 years.
20 years.
Yeah, guess what? He'd never had a job. Now, isn't that incredible? No documented job. So again, the question is, why was he brought in? What was the rationale for inserting such an individual?
Well,
Well,
I was you listen to the comments of the Irish officials. They're talking about apparently Irish have white privilege.
they have Irish privilege.
Well, yeah, because you know how privileged the Irish have been throughout history.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny how now they become white. I always thought it was, I know they're Caucasian, they're light skinned, but they're Irish culture. And this is all part of the deracination process that has occurred in Ireland in the past 30, 40 years. The church scandals, the decline of Catholicism in Ireland, so the globalization of Ireland that was done through a credit pump and dump. So they're destroying Irish culture to deracinate them. Same time, they're pouring foreigners into the country. So in Ireland, many of the Irish don't think themselves Irish anymore. But here's Greg Hood. I read this article. He was talking about it, the hostile Irish government. He summed it up this way. The strategy of moving foreigners into a country because they could be reliable supporters of the political establishment is well known. Northern Ireland exists because British used Protestant settlers to turn Ulster from a hotbed of rebellion into a heart of loyalism. The new pattern of plantation settlement has the same effect, with non-whites pushing Irish out of their newly won country. The Irish had no empire and are indigenous. Now the survivors of famines and persecution learn all along that they're beneficiaries of white privilege. In a democracy, violence isn't allowed because we can discuss our differences. However, if a society doesn't allow discussion, what are other people supposed to do? As Jared Taylor wrote in connection with the Christchurch massacre of 2019, when people have a voice, they speak. When they don't have a voice, they kill. Polls show that most Irish are opposed to demographic transformation, but this is utterly unrepresented in government. What kind of government muzzles its people, ignores their preferences, and replaces them? An illegitimate government of occupation, getting rid of what was the purpose of the Irish struggle for independence. Will the Irish have to do it? Getting rid of it was the purpose of the Irish struggle for independence. Will the Irish have to do that all over again? It
They
appears
have
they'll have to.
to recognize that the government is not stupid. They are traitors.
Oh, by the
They
way,
are.
I was watching the former mayor of Dublin was talking about unity and love. Her last name is Chu.
Gee.
And that's not an Irish name.
No.
The prime minister, the tare second, they call him in Ireland, is Leo Varadkar. He's a homosexual, half Indian. And there's some like Sadiq Khan, who's a member of the Irish Dáil or something. So this is what's happening. Ireland was his independence was basically being an ethno state with Catholic identity, and this global, they're destroying it. First they deracinated it, and now they're pumping the. Why would what agency, what organ? Actually, the government agencies are doing this. Or they're literally targeting Ireland for immigration from North Africa and the Middle East. That's ridiculous. Why Ireland? Because it's
Well,
Ireland.
to
That's why.
destroy it. There's only one rationale, and that is to destroy it. And the Irish people will be destroyed if they don't recognize that there are traitors in political power. And they are not going to be able to be removed through the ballot box, because that's something they control. you're just going to have to stand up to these people. And it starts out with information. They have to start not letting themselves be intimidated by the charges of racism, all this nonsense, and just continue to focus on the idea that the political class has been inhabited by traitors, by people who are absolutely determined to destroy the Irish people and culture. And so that everything else is nonsense. They shouldn't even permit debates on other, you know, components of, well, or is this white national? I mean, forget that stuff. We don't want to hear it. You're a traitor, you're evil, and you have to go. And we have to have mass deportations to try to restore Ireland as best we can to what it was supposed to be at the beginning of all of this EU process, right? This was supposed to help us be a strong country, a strong Ireland, not a destroyed Ireland where you have Algerians who've been in there for 20 years without a job who end up, you know, walking around stabbing
Irish I was people. Watching the supposed riots that occurred afterwards.
Yeah.
And there's some suggestion that some of the riots might have been provoked to justify, because they're trying to pass a hate speech law, which would there's a law.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some of that in there. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a law that says that any material that can be construed to foment or provoke a riot is illegal. You can go to jail for it. What does that mean? I mean, basically, if you're advocating for Irish nationalism, Irish identity, that can be construed as being provoking a riot because they're reacting to, say, some violence. And they can put you in jail for 10 years for that. So, you know, you could say that perhaps that, you know, the same with the January 6th was stoked and fomented, this something like this. But I saw a video, it was taken at face value, is you some Irish guys chasing off some looters.
Yeah.
They're using the riot to loot a store. And they're chasing them off, and there are three black guys that are being chased off. Now, why are there black looters in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, they're welcome here in the United States.
I don't think these are tourists,
right? Yeah, So it's You know, I mean, the attacks upon us are obvious and chronic, and they are. You know, the rationale is inexplicable, and the response has to be clear-mindedness and courage, because this is what people do when they're, you know, in a position of self-defense.
Yep. Okay, Joe.
Tim, well, it's going to be quite a week coming up. We'll talk next week.
Take care.
All right, brother. You too. Bye-bye.